Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today, we look at the hidden brain. Shankar Vedantam, host of the radio program The Hidden Brain, also wrote a book titled The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. We're using that book as a jumping off point for our discussion today with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. Good morning to you all.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
So unconscious bias is at play when we think of that term. We perhaps think of, you know, political bias or racial bias comes to mind. But here's what Vedantam writes in his book. Most people equate the term unconscious bias with prejudice or partiality, but new research was using the term differently. Unconscious bias described any situation where people's actions were at odds with their intentions. The devilish thing was that people never felt manipulated. They rationalized their biases away and even claimed ownership for actions they had not intended. I can see people hearing that going, wait, how could that be?
Yeah, we have been misled, really, thinking that our brains are process information, figure out the world all on a conscious, knowing, analytical basis. That's not true. The majority of the information that our brains are processing is out of our awareness. Has to be that way, because if everything was in our awareness, we couldn't do anything. We'd be just too overwhelmed. If you just look at it that way, we have to have a hidden brain that does things automatically, quickly. Otherwise, we couldn't survive or do things that we normally do. Everybody will accept that, for instance, riding a bike is an automatic thing. And that task, after you learn it, has been assigned to our hidden brain. We're not aware of the various body movements that we do, or drive a car, same thing. We're not aware of the various movements, decisions that we make, because it's all automatic. We don't need to be aware of them. We have a processing system that's very competent in a lot of ways. In some ways, it's like a autopilot of a plane. The autopilot runs just fine. However, there is a pilot that can always, should be, able to override the autopilot. Problems come out when that overriding doesn't take place, which is primarily when the pilot is not paying attention to what the co-pilot is up to. That, I hope, is the message we're going to leave people with, is pay attention to your co-pilot, because it really does influence everything you do throughout every moment of the day, you'd be much better equipped to deal with life if you understand what that co-pilot is doing and why they're doing why it's doing what it is. It's like there's a little puppet in your brain that directs your directs all your behavior. There isn't actually a little puppet, but it's as if there was. The more we know about the antics of that puppet, the better off we are in making reasonable, safe decisions that are in our interest, as opposed to are in the interest of that puppet, which really is older and wiser, I guess, in some ways, than our conscious brain, because that's how our brain started. We were all, all our ancestors didn't have the kind of conscious equipment, didn't have the kind of pilot that we have. They evolved with by the co-pilot, so to speak, and the co-pilot evolved at a time when the world was very, very dangerous, and survival depended upon what decisions the animal made.
I think it's important to know that this isn't new, that right. the hidden part of our brain, going back to the Greeks, going back to obviously Freud and Jung, the Eastern religions have always understood that there are unconscious forces. But what this book and this amazing Shankaravedantin has done is collected. We're at the time where we can start measuring and using scientific methods to confirm this this part of the brain and also understand it better. We, you know, it's actually there to serve us, but it doesn't always serve us in the best way. And I think, Mark, what you're saying is that the more we become aware of the automatic thoughts and beliefs and automatic behaviors and start noticing that, we'll have a little bit better working relationship with the hidden brain and not say, oh my God, I don't want that part of my brain. We have to have it. It's the part that allows us to function automatically in our movements and so on. But it also has collected a lot of unpleasant impressions from the environment, from especially now from we're so bombarded with media where we have so much information coming in that it is really the time to start paying attention to what that hidden part of the brain is doing and how it's influencing us.
Yeah. Shankar says he came up with the term hidden brain as shorthand for a range of influences that manipulated us without our awareness. And when I read that and was thinking of the things that came to mind were marketing, right? Sometimes it's clear how it's intended to manipulate us, and other times it can be pretty subtle, and whether that's, you know, politics or products. And he talks a little bit about politics and voter manipulation in the book. Mark, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, politics is a big area where looking at the hidden brain can be really illustrative. I think one example that he describes bears repeating in a little bit of detail. In 2008, when Obama was running, of course, everybody was afraid that people wouldn't vote for a black man. A black man being in charge makes people uncomfortable, white people uncomfortable. And it depends on how you deal with that discomfort. To decide how you vote. So they were debating, the people that were crafting his campaign were debating, how do you contradict this? Well, the logical thing is, well, you just contradict the information. For instance, the guy has an American birth certificate. He is an American. He is not from some foreign land and foreign religion that's going to usurp the powers and as a president and work against the majority of the people. So how do you get this across? Well, if they just presented that, it would be rejected. You know, the hidden brain doesn't listen to that stuff. The hidden brain is processing a black man in charge as a danger signal, like it or not, because he's different. So they were faced with, well, how do you talk to the hidden brain? Well, they came up with a very interesting one thing they did do correctly, as it turns out, is came up with a commercial that depicted a woman just kind of talking to herself, saying, you know, I feel uncomfortable about Barack Obama being president. I just have a little bit of discomfort. I don't know where I'm going to, how I'm going to vote, he is different. And we've never had it before. And what if he does decide to make all of his decisions benefit blacks to the cost of others? I really don't know what to do. And then she says, but then he is an American and Harvard educated. He's something that everybody his achievements are something that everybody signs on for. And can admire. He loves his daughters, just like I love my daughters. And he values family, just like I value family. After looking at it this way, he really is an American. There's no doubt about it. He is an American. End of commercial.
I thought a very clever part of that ad also was her reference to Kennedy. Yes. And remembering that Kennedy had been Catholic, which had caused her some concern. Well, would he favor sort of causes or issues that were particularly promoted by the Catholic Church? And she got over that, and she remembered that she did not let her concerns about Kennedy's Catholicism stop her from valuing and respecting him. And I thought that was a very clever way to undermine the concern about bias.
Exactly. Yeah, it was whispering to the hidden brain. In a way that could be accepted, as opposed to countered. Because once it's countered, everything is shut off, you can't get through to the other individual.
Yeah. So, Mark, you mentioned the familiar. So how does our hidden brain react to new versus familiar experiences? What's happening in our brain? Is something familiar that we kind of go into, like you said, riding the bike, with that kind of automatic mode, right?
Right.
So
right.
It's different when we see something that's new and not familiar.
Exactly. Yeah, we really need our conscious brain to figure out what's going on when something is new and not familiar. We need to what our conscious mind does is it makes figures out what the rules are of this new event or experience. Once those rules are mastered, the conscious brain, the next time it comes into contact with this new, previously new situation, knows how to act. It doesn't have to be called upon to put a lot of energy into figure it out. That goes down to the hidden brain. The hidden brain then governs after. That's how we learn. The hidden brain governs what the conscious brain has figured out.
I feel like I must be missing something. And Mark, you're always one to refer to evolution and the ultimate importance of of changes that are evolutionarily useful.
Right.
So maybe I missed it in Shankar's writings, but how is this implicit bias, this a tendency sometimes to do things, to make decisions contrary to what we think we should be doing or whatever, how is this evolutionarily helpful?
Thanks for pointing that out. That's critical. Because the hidden brain, as I said before, came first. It values safety. It values survival. So safety has to be a part of it. So something new is anxiety provoking because it's new. You don't know what's going on consciously. And you have this part of the brain that's processing it that values safety. Is not interested in adventures. It's interested in survival. It will influence your conscious decisions in a biased way with safety as the primary goal.
So if we look at for example at the another piece that Shankar writes about, which is the data regarding guns and the presence of guns in America, the presence of guns in people's homes, the evidence that the data, which is really overwhelming in its strength, the data that that people who have guns are statistically much, much more likely to commit suicide than they are to kill another person. The data that shows that the fewer guns that are around, the fewer deaths that will occur, that suicides are much, much more common than murders. And so on and so forth. So you could present, what he points out is that data, when presented to lawmakers, has no influence on what lawmakers think about gun laws.
That's right.
The notion that the more people that have guns, the safer we all are, is contrary to the facts, but has no bearing whatsoever on the passing of laws that promote the Second Amendment. How do we understand that as fundamentally a hidden brain or forebrain matter of safety? Is it because physically, when you see a gun, you feel safer, even though, and the data is somehow dismissed as less powerful than the physical presence in, of a gun? I don't get it.
Doesn't it come down to control, Mark? Isn't this more about control? You feel like you have that gun. You feel like you have more control over a situation than if you didn't have that gun. Is that sort of explain what's happening there?
Exactly. It's a sense of having control. When you have your finger on the trigger, then you have control over what destructive force and where it's released.
Oh, you think you do.
Well, you think you do, yeah. But you feel, not think, you feel like you do. Mm-hmm. That's the critical difference. You feel like you have control. So the hidden brain is satisfied because it's safe. It feels safe, not that it necessarily is. It feels safe. And so that's a typical example of how the hidden brain is illogical, irrational, and really works against our interest at times. It's natural to feel safe. I was in the Army Reserves, and I avoided going to the gun practice session that we were supposed to have. I wanted to avoid guns because I thought I would like it too much, and I didn't want to have that that feeling that I had to rely on something so utterly destructive, and I was afraid, you know, what my impulses might go to. So I've never really shot a gun except at on the boardwalk in Atlantic City at a shooting gallery. it's too powerful a destructive tool that can exert its destruction on an impulse.
I'm with you, Mark. I mean, not that I would afraid I would like guns too much, but many, many, many years ago, I had a boyfriend who actually gave me a gun for Valentine's Day, if you can believe such a romantic gift. And that totally, totally freaked me out. And I was very nervous I ended up giving it back because a police officer friend of mine said, if you're not willing to empty that gun into whoever breaks into your home, into their body, I don't mean shoot them in the leg. I mean, empty the gun in their body. You have no business owning a gun because they'll use it on you. I thought, that's totally... this gun is going to be used on me. So I gave it back.
That's right.
So I get you. Yeah. I mean, but I can see where people do feel like, if they feel like they're good with a gun, maybe they feel like they have more control over a situation than maybe they would. Who knows? Yeah. Okay. We're talking about the hidden brain. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. Today, we are talking about the hidden brain and using Shankar Vedantam's book, The Hidden Brain, as a jumping off point for our discussion with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we think of ourselves as rational, deliberate creatures, but really the conscious brain, slow and deliberate, the hidden brain, designed to be fast. And Mark, you're talking about evolutionary reasons why this would be. So what happens to our unconscious brain when we're under pressure? What kind of impact does pressure have on us?
Well, it interferes with the conscious brain. It cannot handle what impulses might arise from the lower brain. One example he gave in the book was Michael Richards, the guy who played Kramer on Seinfeld. He got into the news in a bad sort of way, in a bad way, when he had an outburst on stage at somebody. He made a lot of racial comments. He was under pressure from various things at that moment. And later on, in kind of doing a psychological autopsy of the event, he didn't know why he behaved that way. He just said he was distracted, pressured, and he was just impatient with a heckler. He was responding to a heckler. So he couldn't, the source of his insults that got national attention, actually, was his hidden brain, because the conscious brain was too overwhelmed with other things. It's that it's robbing the attention of the pilot so that the co-pilot can run wild, so to speak. That's why it's so important for us to pay attention. And when we are stressed, realizing that we're very poor, we can be very poor problem solvers, and we're more susceptible to quick thinking, quick answers that are sourced in the hidden brain, that whose value has to do with survival and safety, without really seeing the whole picture. It sees the trees and not the wood, not the woods, not the forest.
Also, I think we end up a lot of times when that's occurring to find the quick fix in a drink and a drug.
There you go.
Quick sexual encounter. There's a lot of hidden brain urges to just get a quick fix. And that folds into bad decision making, et cetera, et cetera. And the ultimate thing, like, I don't know how I did. Why did I do that? I don't know how I did. That was really stupid. Why did I, drink and drive? What? I don't remember. So I think that's another piece of this that he doesn't cover, because that wasn't part of the book, but it is what we do as folks. And there's just so much societal pressure to find the quick remedy for any kind of stress, any kind of discomfort. That's another piece of this, is like, you kind of want to keep the executive functioning going when you're under stress, right, even if the impulse from the hidden brain is to just stop that stress. You want to encourage critical thinking. You want to encourage insight and deliberate decision making, even though it's boring.
That's right.
That's kind of,
and
like
it's hard, especially. I mean, you're talking about addictions, you're talking about the root of addictions. The alcohol or the drug is a quick solution to a discomforting feeling, situation, set of circumstances, it is exceedingly. It is exceedingly rewarding. That's addiction.
And also, when you're talking about the pressure and that kind of, quick thinking, which is going to the hidden brain, that comes back to what, all of our grandmothers said, sleep on it, make your decision in the morning, right? It was good advice.
One person who writes a lot and thinks a lot about these things, although he uses different terms than Shankar does, is Steven Pinker, who was just interviewed for an article in the Times. And I just want to read something briefly that he wrote. He said,
sure.
People are pretty rational when it comes to their own lives. They get the kids clothed and fed and off to school on time, and they keep their jobs and pay their bills. But people hold beliefs, not because they are probably provably true or false, but because they're uplifting, they're empowering, they're good stories. The key, though, is what kind of species are we? And he goes on to talk about, being rational versus irrational, and he's a really smart guy. He speaks and writes in different terms, perhaps, than the sort of neuroanatomical dissection that Shankar focuses on. But it's true, when you think about people, everybody who's listening to the show and everybody who's on this panel knows people who you think of as being good people, nice people, but who hold political beliefs that just seem so contrary to what would make them a good person or a nice person. And as Steven Pinker says, people hold beliefs that are empowering and that are good stories. And I think that part of what's happened over these last several years is that, I think to some extent people's fundamental prejudices or biases have been fed and have been nurtured by various sources. And that's true, I think, on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. And when you hear somebody with a national voice speak the way you think, it sort of reinforces what you thought, even if perhaps you might have been embarrassed previously by your
validates,
own thoughts.
Validates. And I think this kind of goes to this whole idea of belonging, right? Of these small group belonging, which Shankar does talk about in the book. We've talked about this many times, that whole tribe thing, right? Being a member of the tribe. Mark, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's you're pointing out how groups form comfort. And looking, having like-minded people to interact with or get your information from, whatever, is comforting. You feel safe with it. And you feel special. I think this plays a part in the vaccine resistors or deniers. They stick to their guns. I mean, we've seen them interviewed on TV and how they're not going to let the government take over their body. They stick to that, and as if their concept of freedom trumps everything. Well, their concept of freedom is really in the service of having them feel a part of a special group that kind of has insight into this. So we're special, and we have power, regardless of what the cost is. It's a sense of belonging to a group that is a minority, thankfully, but they're still special. And the tug to stay in that mindset is very, very powerful, especially when the world is so uncertain. This pandemic has simply made life uncertain in a way that nobody in our lifetime has felt. We're really kind of post-war generation, and this is, we didn't live through a depression or a flu epidemic like in 1920. This has really taken us back.
And I think uncertainty, of course, is scary. And I would say, for some of the group you're talking about, some of these people who are feeling they don't want to get the vaccine, I think uncertainty might be playing a role there as well. They feel uncertain about what might happen to them. I don't think it's just like government control. I think there's many reasons why people decide not to do that. But sure. One of the first story in the book talks about a woman who is a rape victim, and we've talked about, sometimes what we believe isn't always reality. And she was so sure when she identified, the person who raped her. And this man went to prison. Later, DNA found that he was not the person who had raped her. And she did have that little sliver of doubt. But once she talked, into her faith community and again, some of these smaller groups sort of reinforced, her thought that, yep, this is the guy. And later she meets him after he gets out of prison, and she sees his teeth. Had she seen his teeth before that, she might not have said, this is the guy. His teeth are crooked, and the guy had straight teeth.
The actual rapist had
straight teeth, and this guy that had got sent to prison had crooked teeth. But there were other things that he had that were similar to the guy, and she was just so sure. And it makes you kind of think about. I guess it's a lot of times why in court eyewitness testimony isn't always because it's not accurate, right?
Mindy, I think the point of that story was the confirmation she felt when she went to the comfort of her church and was surrounded by others who supported her. She felt like safe. So it's mm-hmm. safe to say that this is the guy who raped me. Her doubt vanished. And what I think is happening with social media is no matter what opinion, interest, kink you have, you're going to find a group on social media that is your warm place. Yeah. You can say anything and post it, and you will find people, of course, opposing it, but you'll always find people who will support you and make you feel safe, make you feel validated, make your idea be okay. This is a revolution. This is a revolution in terms of platforms for people and to say anything. And they'll always be opposition, but there'll always be someone who validates your position, your interest, your idiosyncrasy. And I think that's a tremendous influence on how our current society has become so fragmented, is because you can always find a safe place to be supported in your belief.
That's right.
What about bias in young children? That I thought was interesting. Thoughts on bias? You know, we have a tendency to think when we see bias coming from young children, it's coming from, you know, their parents or people around them, but not necessarily so.
No, it's when you look at it, you know, with a third eye, so to speak, or a different angle, it really is part of a development, simple, normal development. For instance, if they look at how infants or young children or toddlers, different ages, recognize faces, they find that, say, a Chinese baby born in a Chinese society will recognize and gravitate to Chinese faces and will easily be able to distinguish their mother, especially, from other Chinese faces. As they get older, that persists because it's familiar. A Chinese person would have difficulty distinguishing a Caucasian's face, you know, distinguishing different features, same way back and forth, same way black and white. You form in the first hours, days of life, a bond with a face that looks like yours. That's basically imprinted in the hidden brain. And so then there's been research that shows sometimes in mixed neighborhoods, say, the kids will have interracial friendships. There's a lot of it in pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, the early years. However, when they start to get around fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, there's a what's called, what he calls in the book, an extinction event, where the interracial friends drop off, and much less interracial friends. And why should that happen? Well, that's the age when people, when kids growing up, want to be part of a group. Want to know who they are and feel safe with part of a group. And race, or say, is just one distinguishing feature that can define a group. The statistics on this show clearly that by the time the kids get to high school, they may have no interracial friends like they used to. In terms of real close friends. And I think we've jumped to a wrong conclusion when we say that prejudice is bred into us. In part, it can be, certainly, but in part, it just is normal development in terms of defining yourself. That sets a sense of yourself that is influenced by how somebody looks, and skin is the first thing you notice when you're looking at somebody. It's the outer part of their body. It shows another perspective on this, and maybe we're not such bad people, you know, when we have a little bit of a gut feeling of discomfort around people of the opposite race or a different race. Another example of this is discomfort around homosexuality. Kids learn that men just don't kiss men. It's not something that men do, and so they're not familiar with it. It's a new event when they witness that, And that's what they start feeling uncomfortable with, because it's unfamiliar. And how do you make sense of this? The task in a diverse society is to recognize this feeling, accept it in yourself. It's not that you're bad or that you're some kind of crazy homophobic. It's natural. It's new. And so you have to talk. You have to kind of whisper back to the hidden brain that this is okay. But however, that hidden brain can can influence you. Say that after you walk in a building, you see two men kissing on a street. Later on, they're in your office waiting room, competing for a job. And you have them sitting next to others that are clearly heterosexual, and you're going to be influenced by that hidden brain feeling unless you're aware of it. And you might pass up a very good candidate just because of a hidden brain sense of discomfort, and also familiarity also plays a part. You're more likely to hire, say, if you're in that position, somebody of your own race. There's also interesting research that you're more likely not to hire people that are obese. There's an inherent bias against that, because obese means that you're not disciplined. You don't take care of yourself, things like that. So there's a little hidden bias, and this is shown in statistics.
And it isn't that the perception is that if you're obese, that's not the reality, but yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're talking about the hidden brain. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the hidden brain, and we're using Shankar Vedantam's book, The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives, as a jumping off point for our discussion. With us is psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Anne Gagan. So we're talking about all these, unconscious bias that we all have, and it affects all parts of our lives. So I'm sure people are thinking, well, how would I know? And there is, we've talked about this before, the implicit association test that Harvard does. I think sometimes when people, Mark, you were surprised, you took the test and you were surprised at the results, right? When you took it?
Yeah, it illustrated what I thought I was biased against, but really illustrated it, with numbers and clear. It's a word association test, and on the computer it just flashes up a word, and then you hit another thing that is associated with it, and the speed at which you distinguish is one of the measurements that they take, because speed again is a hidden brain measurement that means something. So that the speed does reflect the kind of decisions you make consciously. They have it on all sorts of topics: race, religion, sexual orientation, you name it. And so if you have any doubts or want to explore some of your biases, this is an excellent way to do it. You do it privately. Nobody knows about it.
I also think that it's we're at such a wonderful point in time. I mean, this book is remarkable, and his radio podcast is remarkable, that he is exposing through his storytelling and through the research. Everything he does is based on research, how pervasive this is. And therefore, I think it prompts us to be more responsible, to reflect as, what's going on in my head when I see somebody walking down the street that isn't the same race, and I'm used to, white folks just being on our street. What happens to me? What do I think? What initial impulse do I have? And pay attention to that. And then again, use the executive functioning, to say, well, that guy's walking up the street because he's wants to go to the beach like any other person. But we're at a really important time to take more responsibility for our thoughts, beliefs, and behavior, and to challenge ourselves. And then I think, again, with so much happening around racial justice and seeing more people of color in the media, seeing more people of color, seeing more people of gender differences in our society, to the more exposure, that's feeding our hidden brain. The exposure, we don't have to consciously say, oh, there's a transgender person, but we could walk past them and our brain can have it, so that the otherness is not so dominant. The otherness mm-hmm. is not leading us to a behavior that we don't even understand. So this is a really very important time we're living in. And, you know, Mindy, you mentioned through mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, there's a lot of tools now that we have to become more aware of why we're doing what we're doing and examine our beliefs around that, and perhaps challenge our beliefs a bit to say, is that true? No, that really isn't true. Why am I doing that? Why am I thinking that? Why am I feeling that? Why? And if you don't even get a why, let's just stop doing it. It's not right, you know, to call ourselves out a little bit. Sure. So I think it's important. He doesn't do that much in the book. He's just presenting the cases. But I think it's important that we reflect on that.
I think it's also worthwhile to distinguish between errors that we make, and I put the word errors in quotes to some degree, errors that we make or biases that we have, which I will say I attribute in some ways to technology, from errors that we make because of human nature. So for example, Shankar has one of my favorite of his podcasts is about the placebo effect and research that's done on the placebo effect, which really has nothing to do with racial bias. It has nothing to do with many of the biases that we're talking about here today, but really has a lot to do with how the brain is constructed in order to lead us in a certain direction. And that placebo effect, I believe, would be authentic and powerful, regardless of whether the wheel had ever been invented or not. I think, at the same time, I think a lot of the biases that we're talking about would never have become evident or real in a practical way if the wheel had never been invented, if we couldn't get on a plane and fly, if Marshall McLuhan had never written about the global village, which now has become, you know, very much, I mean, what is a more compelling case for the global village than the spread of this virus from one part of the globe to another? This could never have happened if people didn't get on planes or boats and travel all over the world, as if, you know, we didn't think that we could be anywhere, go anywhere, live anywhere with anyone. You know, there was a time when people kind of stayed where they were born and never went more than 20 or 30 miles from where they were given birth to. And things were very different in a very profound way. But the global village and the what some people have even called the browning of our society as a result of transience and so on, this really has forced us. I mean, we wouldn't be having this conversation today, I think, if it weren't for the very practical ways in which life has changed for all of us, as not only as a society, as an American society, but just as a globe, as a human population. I mean, I often think about that. And when I'm thinking about, well, how do I know if what I'm thinking is correct or real or something I should challenge? I think about, well, and would I feel the same way? Would I think the same way if it weren't for technology? if I didn't have social media pumping me full of whatever, if I didn't have five different newspapers that I read online every day, et cetera, if I were just like a person being alive, you know, surviving, what would I think and what would I feel? And I find that that's sort of, in some ways, at times, a helpful way to check what I'm thinking and feeling.
Yeah. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi, I'll try to keep this brief because I know it's almost time for you to sign off. The thing about obesity, and I have I apparently have a bias about it. My husband was a patient at Beth Israel in Boston, and he was very sick with liver disease. And they had a doctor come from Deaconess to consider him for a transplant, which they did accept him. But I was shocked when he walked in the room. He was absolutely enormous. And my vision was, here's this huge man, you know, operating my husband, and what if he had a stroke or a heart attack or something in between? And afterwards, I thought, well, that's ridiculous. In the long run, we decided against it because liver transplants are quite difficult and not as safe as, say, a kidney or some other transplant. But anyway, when you were talking about it, I said, my God, that's what happened to me when that man walked into the room.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Janet, and you recognized it, and you recognize it, which is part of the battle. Thank you for sharing. Mark, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I just hope that other people will take a lesson from this discussion and start listing some things that they can identify about their own decision-making that was based largely on hidden brain factors as opposed to conscious intention. That's the whole thing about the hidden brain. It leads us to act against our conscious intentions, or what they might be. This is a self-education process, and I hope other people will pick up that, what she just described.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Final thought, Anne. You have final thought?
Well, I just think we're lucky to have somebody like Shankaravanathan writing about this in such an entertaining and interesting way. And I encourage everybody to listen to his series. This book was written a while ago, and he's had hundreds of podcasts since then, and they're one after another. So fascinating.
Yeah. We're all fans for sure.
We're also lucky to have Anne's participation in this for the past, year or 2 years.
Two years, I think. Yeah. Thank you.
It goes quick. Yeah. I know you, Anne is changing with geographical change, but she's been extremely valuable contributor.
Thank you, Mark.
We aren't losing her completely. I mean, we won't have Anne every month, but we will still have Anne occasionally. So we're not saying goodbye. We're saying time. I will have a link at our website to the book, The Hidden Brain by Shankaravanathan, and also a link to that implicit association test. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Wartz and Schwartz, and social worker Anne Gagan. Thank you, as always. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Jonathan, Mark.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.